All right, hi everybody, and welcome to lecture 27 in this ancient history program of History at Our House for the elementary class. We're going to get into Mesopotamian history here. But before we do, on behalf of those of you who are on the recordings, I'm just going to go over something that I already discussed with my live students. So I'm going to share my screen here, and I'm going to show you the... Well, this happens to be the lower elementary class webpage, but the upper L looks very similar, right? And I'm going to show you that something that could very well become a regular feature here of the way that the classes are given, and that is a little link at the beginning of each class called a self-test. I don't know if I'm going to post it in this particular way every time. I might come up with a different method. But this is what I think I'm going to be doing here. And so what you can do before listening to any recording of a class, or before joining a live class, for that matter, at any time in the future, is go onto the class webpage, bring up the self-test, and print out a copy. And then you can read the little questions that are on there. And what that will do is help you to get ready for class. And also hopefully help you to carefully pay attention to what's being said in class so that you can find the answers to the questions. And then probably what we'll do in connection with this little self-test is at the very beginning of the next class, we'll quickly go over the answers. So this will give everybody, a kind of way to connect the classes, a way to have to track your kind of your work within each individual class. So I'm hoping that that will benefit people. And of course, I look forward to hearing back from everybody about how well this goes. All right. So let me know what you think of this and what you might like it to look like, or any changes you might like. All right, because I'm definitely willing to modify this to make it work as well as possible. All right, so anyway, let's get into this Mesopotamian history here where we have no pyramids to excite our interest, and we have no ziggurats either. Unfortunately, the great buildings of the Mesopotamians, they did build them, and we have ruins of them, and even, which I think I didn't get to yesterday, we have some kind of spectacular stories that are told concerning Mesopotamian ziggurats. One of the most interesting stories about them is from the Bible. And we have a story in the Christian Bible that is about something called the Tower of Babel. And this is a painting. It's a fanciful kind of imaginary reproduction or representation of what perhaps such a tower would have looked like in the ancient world. But anyway, it gives you an idea of how people imagined the great ziggurats of Mesopotamia. And the story of the Tower of Babel is kind of like an ancient skyscraper. And Babel is just another word for Babylon, which was a very important city in Mesopotamia. So the stories about Mesopotamia are a part of what people know about Mesopotamia, or at least have heard about it, right? Because we wouldn't necessarily call it knowledge, but we hear stories about it, including, for instance, the biblical story of the Tower of Babel. All right, so there has long been some interest in this place in Mesopotamia and what it was like, but it took a while for Western historians to learn anything about it. It was an area that was very isolated, for one thing, from Europeans. So remember that Napoleon, if we go back to this map here of the British Empire that we looked at once when we were talking about Napoleon, we talked about Napoleon going to Egypt, right? So let's go ahead and put a nice bright rectangle, yellow rectangle around Egypt, just to make sure everybody remembers where Egypt is. So there's Egypt, right? And so Napoleon had gone across from France to Egypt, and his goal was not merely to go to Egypt, but to go all the way here to India. Because India, which is marked in red on here, was part of the greatest empire in the world, the British Empire. And he wanted to attack it. He wanted to conquer it. So when Napoleon went to Egypt, we know that that led to the discovery of what was the key to all of Egyptian history. Everybody knows this by now, but what the heck? Rosetta, go ahead.
The Rosetta Stone,
right, okay. So that, somebody needed to find that in order to start deciphering Egyptian history, and that happened in 1799. Well, it took a long time for somebody to find something like that for Mesopotamian history. Because what happened was, Napoleon did go to Egypt here, but he never made it past that. He wanted to go in this area that we call Mesopotamia and Persia, but he was stopped by the British. And then what happened was, the British said, well, we have this empire over here. This is our spot, right? This belongs to us, and we don't want anybody else going over there. So, hey, wait a minute. What's going on over here? Is this an area that can kind of defend itself and where people like Napoleon will not be able to conquer it and then attack India? What they didn't know much about this area. They knew the people there were Muslims, in other words, people who followed the religion of Islam, and they had some kingdoms and empires, but they didn't know all that much about it, and they were worried. So the British started sending ambassadors and, missions, you might call them, to this region to find out more about it. And this is what starts the history, the study of the history of Mesopotamia. So we have ambassadors, we have army officers and so on. Kind of like this guy over here. Here's kind of our a good symbol of the British army officer of the British Empire who can you guys see that highlight down here? Who would go out into the world, right? Here is the world map, and the British Empire is all over the world. And so they started to go to more and more places and wanted to learn about them. And what they found about Mesopotamia was that if they wanted to learn more about its history, that they were going to have to figure out this stuff. Patrick's interested. Looks like the kind of secret writing that he would invent for his kind of... He likes to do that sort of stuff, and he's been interested in Egyptian hieroglyphics and stuff, and you know, when you want to make your own language or a spy language or whatever, right? This is called cuneiform. So the writing of the Mesopotamians is called cuneiform. And so this is the kind of language that people would have to figure out if they wanted to understand Mesopotamian history. Very interesting stuff. In order to make this kind of writing, what people did was they got a wet clay tablet, like this person here who's doing it in modern times, and they would get a reed or a wedge, some kind of stick, and then they would simply press it into the wet clay. And, well, once you had pressed it into place, well, you could do a number of things. The simplest would be to put the clay into the sun in the middle of the day and let it dry. Or, if you wanted to make it even stronger, you could bake it. The more the heat, the stronger it would be. And the more permanent it would be. But basically, this was the method of writing of the people of Mesopotamia, and historians had to figure out how to read this stuff if they were going to understand Mesopotamian history at all. So, this is what takes us to the question of, what is the Rosetta Stone of Mesopotamian history, right? What thing permitted, what object or artifact permitted the translation of these objects and the understanding, the learning of Mesopotamian history? And the answer is something called the Behistun inscription. The Behistun inscription. This is the Rosetta Stone of Mesopotamian history. So let's take a close look at it. It's a fascinating object. Here it is. Here's kind of a good picture of it, taken from far, far away. Just wait for it to load up here. So you can see, this is one picture of it. We'll look at a couple different ones. You can see that it's kind of an artwork on stone, but you can also see here all of the writing underneath as part of it and so on that is also etched into the stone. So let's see if we can take a closer look over here at maybe another version of this Behistun inscription here. Here's where it was found, by the way. So it is in modern-day Iran, very close to Iraq, very close to Mesopotamia. And so this is, you can definitely go on Wikipedia and find out more about the Behistun inscription. But let me see if I can show you. Here's kind of a far away picture that gives you an idea of what it is. It is a large inscription. It's not like the Rosetta Stone, which is about man-sized, you know. It's a huge inscription on the side of a mountain. So somebody had to climb up all the way to the top of this mountain. Well, not the top, but, the middle anyway, right? On the side of a cliff, basically. And write all this stuff into the stone. That is pretty cool. So a British Army officer named Henry Rawlinson was the one who found it. Let's see here. Henry Rawlinson, is he described over here? Let's see, I will scroll down to the decipherment of it. Let's see, translation. There's a section on translation. So there's a whole bunch of interesting descriptions here. You can find some really interesting pictures of cuneiform. Here's an interesting one. It really shows you all of those wedge-shaped things. And then if you talk about the translation, here it is. A character named Sir Henry Rawlinson is the man who figured it out. So, what he did was, he found that on the Behistun inscription, there were three different kinds of language. Now, does that sound familiar? Right? It's very much like the Rosetta Stone. He found three forms of writing. So, why do you think that is? Interesting fact, very, very similar to the point, to the way that the Rosetta Stone works. Why were there three languages on it? Which is why it becomes such a useful thing. Opal, what's your guess?
So everybody can understand it, even if they speak a different language.
There you go. So whoever was in that area, they didn't necessarily speak the same language. That tells us that there were people of different languages in the same area involved together, and that this message from whoever it was to everybody else, right? It was obviously an important message because it was put on a mountainside. Whoever was going to see this was going to understand it because it was going to be there in three different languages. Okay, so let's see. What were the three different languages of the script? I don't know. Are they? Yeah, here is one of them. Yeah, here we go. One is Old Persian, and another was called Elamite, which is a very interesting language connected to the history of the Holy Land. And then they're calling this Babylonian, would be kind of another one. But anyway, people have slightly different names for what they're calling it. So there were three different languages there. And we are fortunate because European historians could read Old Persian. Some of them could. And the reason why they could do that was because of this very important event that we are going to learn about. The war between the Persians and the Greeks. We know that the Greeks, well, we know that Greece is classical. And that means that it passed on its ideas and values to people much later in history. Still today, people like Greek ideas and values. Okay? So that is something that a lot of historians know how to read Greek, or certainly did know how in the past. It was very popular. Well, as it turns out, because the Greeks had so much trouble with the Persians, there were documents that were in both Greek and Persian. And so historians who were interested in the wars of the Greeks and the Persians and the history of their connection, also some of them learned Persian. So it works the same way here as with the Rosetta Stone. When you know one of the languages, well, you use that one, and you look for patterns, you look for repeating patterns to help you figure out the other ones. And gradually, they were able to do that. And they learned that the Behistun inscription concerned the life and accomplishments of a Persian king called Dariush the Great. We will learn about Dariush because he is the one who attacked Greece. Shame on you, Dariush. But anyway, he was the one who attacked Greece and started the Greco-Persian Wars. So we'll learn about him when we get there. But so basically, this was what the Behistun inscription was about. And it started a wave of translations, learning about the various parts of Mesopotamian history. And so when we get to the very, very beginning of it, which is what you're going to do if you're going to do this particular map of Mesopotamian history, right? Here is the map key, and everybody should work on this map. If you haven't already, you should definitely do it before Monday and fill in the four parts of it. And what historians learn by reading all of the documents with the cuneiform writing on it was that at the very beginning of Mesopotamian history, there were two major kingdoms along the rivers. We have the Tigris. When we're doing Mesopotamian geography, it's always about the two rivers, right? We have the Tigris and we have the Euphrates. And what historians learned is that at the very beginning of Mesopotamian history, the region was divided up into basically two kingdoms. One of them was called Sumer. That's why it's capitalized here. And the other was called Akkad. Okay, so at the beginning of Mesopotamian history, we find two main kingdoms, Sumer and Akkad. And this is kind of interesting because it's just like Egyptian history, right? At the beginning of Egyptian history, we have two kingdoms, Lower Egypt and Upper Egypt. And how does the story begin? Who's going to guess here? How does the history of Mesopotamia begin? Let's say if we're going to have a pattern here, right? What's going to be your guess, Henry Wyatt?
Is it Wyatt?
Yeah.
It's some great ruler that's going to unify Todd and Summer.
Yes, right, exactly. We're going to have an act of unification. Because in history, we only start to see the history of any particular people anywhere when they start to have an organized society that's pretty big and stable. When we have little cities and little things next to each other where they're always fighting, we just don't get any history. That's called anarchy. There is no one ruler. So it's a mess. And things don't tend to work out very well there. We never get any history for places that have anarchy. So what we look for, what we always tend to see in history, and this is true for China, this is true for India, this is true for Egypt, this is true for Mesopotamia, all the ancient societies. What we see at the beginning of the story is the story of somebody that's going to put all of it together. He's going to unify it. Right, so when historians went back into the records and so on, what they found out was, okay, these places, some of them are labeled here, some of the most ancient cities in all of the world, Ur and Uruk and Ashur and all of them, I put a button, and Babylon here is a later one as well. I put some of the most important cities of Mesopotamia on there for you. So what they had was separate cities that were each ruled by a local ruler. So this is very similar to Egypt. Does everybody remember what the local rulers were called in Egypt before the country was unified? And later on, they were kind of lords of the local areas. Patrick?
The nomarchs?
The nomarchs. Okay, so basically what historians were learning as they were putting together the history of Mesopotamia was they found that just like in Egypt where you had nomarchs, in Mesopotamia you had characters called Patazes. Sometimes I like to, it makes me giggle, some of the names that we find in Mesopotamian history. I'm going to put them this word in the chat box for you. And so a local ruler in Egypt was called a Patazi, and so we could put, say, for instance, Mesopotamia equals nomarch in Egypt. Okay, kind of that's kind of the equal, the relatively equal figure. Okay, and so we learn of the story of Patazes, or the historians learn, the historians who studied the really, really early story of this area learn about Patazes, and then they learn about people that that become the kings of one particular area. And so when we have, for instance, a pharaoh in Egypt, let's see, we have a character in Mesopotamia. Potamia is kind of like, I'm going to chat this to you guys as well. We have a character, a title in Mesopotamia of a ruler who becomes a king. He is known as a Lugal. So these are kind of definitely funny sounding names. So we have Patazes and Lugals. And we have a character at the beginning of Mesopotamian history who is known as, yeah, this is one funny one, and there's no way to spell it properly here. But his name is Lugalzagizi. Kind of one of the first characters in all of Mesopotamian history. And Lugalzagizi was the king of Sumer. So let me write that out here. Gizi was the, what am I going to do? King of Sumer around this time in history. 2275. It's about the best we can do. Historians go and they look at Mesopotamian history. And, oops, sorry, I misspelled it the second time around. That wasn't good. That's going to confuse you. So it's not that important, but it is just, you know, one of the facts that we are going to bother to work with here. So Lugalzagizi was the king of Sumer, circa 2275. Well, what we learn is that he was defeated by a great conqueror who became the first unifier of Mesopotamia. Sumer was conquered by Akkad, and we have the first great unifier of Mesopotamian history. So, now, his name was Sargon of Akkad. Let me show it to you. Here is kind of a cool web page on Wikipedia about Sargon of Akkad, the first unifier of Mesopotamia. So, now, is this Sargon? No, historians don't think that it is. But anyway, it's kind of a cool mask that shows kind of like what a king of Mesopotamia would look like. So Sargon of Akkad was the first. And this is really where we're going to get our story rolling of Mesopotamia. Sargon of Akkad, you could say, he is the, what would we say? He is the so-and-so of Mesopotamian history. Let's see if you guys can follow the pattern here. So the Behistun inscription is the Rosetta Stone of Mesopotamian history. A Patesi is a nomarch of Mesopotamian history. Okay. Sargon, a Lugal would be a pharaoh of Mesopotamian history. So we're doing comparisons between Mesopotamia and Egypt, right? So Sargon of Akkad is the what of Mesopotamian history? Julia?
Menes-Narmer.
Yeah, excellent. Sargon of Akkad is the Menes-Narmer of Mesopotamian history. He's the first ruler to really put everything together. He conquers Lugalzagizi. He creates what's called the Akkadian Empire. He's the first one to put the whole region together. All right. So, historians figure that this happened, like I said, around 2250 BC. It's very hard for us to know. When historians look at Mesopotamian history, they have a really hard time figuring out when things happened. Because, well, when we look back at history, we have to work with the records that the kings made of what they did. And it can be a pretty tricky thing. Because, well, the kings, as we know from Egyptian history, what would be an interesting example of the kings making it hard for us to figure out something? Who can remember something in Egyptian history? For instance, maybe you might remember, how about Akhenaten making it hard for us to figure certain things out? What would he have done that, remember when he tried to change Egyptian religion, what did he do that would make it hard for us to know Egyptian history well? Rosetta?
He destroyed quite a few things.
He would destroy old temples, and he would get his soldiers to erase inscriptions in temples and so on. And what else did we say in general about the pharaohs and how they treated their own ancestors? And the graves of their ancestors. Those rotten pharaohs. What did they do? Rosetta?
Raid them.
They raided the tombs of previous pharaohs in order to get the good stuff in them and have their tomb be really nice, which makes a really confusing history. Well, yeah, the other thing that kings are very, very commonly do is they exaggerate how great they were. Right? They like kings are just that kind of people, right? They are not nice and well-behaved people. They are rulers. They are basically bullies. They want to everybody else to think that they're so great. So they like to make stuff up. And they like to pretend things, and they like to exaggerate, and they like to outright lie about the things that they do. So when historians go back and they read the story of the early kings of Mesopotamia before Sargon, they find some hilarious things. For instance, they find that there are lists of kings that say how long each person was the king, and guess how long each king is ruling. At the beginning of the list, we have kings that say that they ruled for 80,000 years. Nice one, right? What does this remind you of? What kind of creature would be able to do that, supposedly, right? If we imagine, you know, supposedly a king, and we're going to kind of have a story, which is obviously fake, so we would call that a myth. And he rules, and he claims to have ruled for 80,000 years. What kind of person is that, Henry Wyatt?
Someone who's pretending he's a god.
Yeah, right. Isn't that interesting that in Mesopotamian history, we have this, again, this kind of storytelling about god kings, right? Somebody who's pretending to kind of be supernatural and so on. And the stories are obviously not true. And so historians can't make any sense of it because there's so much exaggerating, there's so much pretending, and there's so much lying going on that basically we can't know anything until about the time of Sargon of Akkad. We know that Mesopotamia is very ancient. And some people think that it's more ancient than Egypt. But there's just no way to figure out what actually happened because the kings are so plainly lying and exaggerating and faking all kinds of stuff. And we just cannot put a good story together. But at least we can start to make sense of what is going on in the story around the time of Sargon of Akkad. Because the kings are not pretending to rule for 80,000 years anymore, or 800, or anything else that's impossible. It's becoming pretty much a sensible amount of time, and the lists that we have of Mesopotamian kings, we can kind of take them, and then we can put them together with documents from other people, and we can compare them side by side and start to make sense of them, and we start to get a story. So what we'll do on Monday is I'll whisk you through kind of the early story of Mesopotamia. There really is nothing there that a modern person absolutely needs to know until we get to one famous ruler. One famous ruler. Really, if there's one person, only one, that the modern student of Mesopotamia needs to know, it's going to be this person. Not Sargon, because, yeah, Sargon did unify Mesopotamia for the first time. Fine. But that's not so impressive. It's not so interesting because nobody built any pyramids after that or did anything really permanent or interesting. But there is a king that did something quite fascinating to us, and that tells us a lot about archaic life. His name might be familiar to you, so I will just mention it briefly. His name was Hammurabi. So, when we return on Monday, we will learn the story of Hammurabi. Okay, everybody, that'll do it for today. Tomorrow, of course, History Through Art continues. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye.
Bye-bye.